Hello and welcome to Haaretz Weekend, a glossy audio supplement on Israel, the Middle East and the Jewish world. I'm Simon Spungin. On today's show... Don't blame it on sunshine. With pomp and ceremony, Israel swore in its new president this week. Isaac Herzog, the son of a former president, the grandson of a former chief rabbi, and the outgoing head of the Jewish Agency, took the oath of office on Wednesday, becoming the 11th president of the State of Israel. He replaced the warm, avuncular, and much-loved Reuven Rivlin, who ended his seven-year term by donning a disguise and mixing unidentified with Israeli citizens. Joining me today to discuss the legacy of Israel's outgoing president and to cast an eye over his newly installed replacement, it's Anshul Pfeffer. How's it going, Anshul?
Hi up, Simon. It's coming home.
Well, we're only airing this on Friday, so that might be...
It's still coming home.
So, Anshul, as I say, we are recording this on Wednesday, the day that Isaac Herzog is set to be sworn in as Israel's 11th president. Before we look ahead to his seven-year tenure as Israel's first citizen, and before we talk a little about the man he's replacing, let's talk about the role of president in the State of Israel. What powers does the president have, and what does he actually do?
Well, the president, on a daily basis, is Israel's national master of ceremonies. You know, he lives in that residence in Rehavia in Jerusalem and gets up in the morning, puts on a suit and tie, and has a reception for the melon growers, and then there's another reception for marrow donors, and then ambassadors coming to present their credentials. In the evening, there's another reception for some visiting dignitary, and this president has to stand there in his suit and tie, smiling, shaking hands, saying some appropriate remarks, doing that over and over again, four or five times a day, day in, day out. Occasionally, ceremonies will take place at other places, on Mount Herzl, in the Knesset, etc. And you know, that's the job. He's the head of state, which basically means he does all the things that the prime minister is either too controversial because the prime minister is an active politician, or the prime minister simply doesn't have the time to do it because the prime minister is actually running the country. Yeah. It's not a not important job. Obviously, very senior Israeli figures have vied for the honor. But when we talk about actual powers the president has, the president doesn't really have very many actual powers. There are perhaps two things in Israeli law, constitutional law, that the president has to do. One is sign pardons, and even there, the expectation is the president will act according to recommendations that he gets from the Justice Ministry. Mm. And then there's the small matter of conferring the mandate on one of the members of the Knesset after an election to form a new government, which is also something that the expectation is that the president will simply meet with the leaders of the various parties in the Knesset, receive their endorsements, and whoever gets the most endorsements will be called by the president again to form a new government. So that really, the president shouldn't have that much room for consideration on either of these issues. However, they do by law. They can decide. They can think about it. They can deliberate, and as we saw in recent times with the four stalemated elections, sometimes the president has something of a role, though at the end of the day, the president is just there sort of a conduit for the endorsement of the different parties elected. Though today's Wednesday, obviously this will be out on Friday, but as today we'll be swearing in the new Herzog II, it's worth remembering that his father, Chaim Herzog, who was president after the 1984 election, which was also a stalemate, did play a pivotal role in bringing together the then leaders of Labour and Likud, Shimon Peres and Yitzhak Shamir, into the National Unity and Rotation government. But once again, it wasn't the president making the decisions. He was simply there to try and help the parties get together.
Mm. All right. Well, we'll get on to the issue of pardons and maybe any role that any political role that Rivlin might or might not have played or might have considered playing, according to some reports. But you wrote a piece about Rivlin in which you said that he was the best president Israel could have expected in such fraught times. How so?
Well, the president, at the end of the day, can only act in whatever space the government and mainly the prime minister allows him to act in. And we go back to the very first president, Chaim Weizmann, who called himself the prisoner of Rehovot because he was barely allowed to do anything, and he complained that the only place he's allowed to stick his nose in is his handkerchief. He was appointed by David Ben-Gurion, Israel's founding prime minister, basically because Ben-Gurion sort of owed him that Weizmann had played a very critical role in 1947 in leading up to the United Nations resolution on forming Jewish state, the partition resolution. And even though Weizmann had sort of been already pushed out of leadership of the Zionist movement by Ben-Gurion long before that, Ben-Gurion needed him as a sort of elder statesman, master diplomat. So it would have seemed weird if Weizmann had not had a role in the foundation of the state, so they made him the president. But Ben-Gurion made very sure not to leave Weizmann any real role as president, even when Weizmann had the temerity to send a telegram to President Truman in the United States. Ben-Gurion told him, or the government told him, don't contact the President of the United States without us giving you the green light to do so. So it was very clear even then that the president can only do what the government allows him to do. Well, obviously, I'm saying him because for the last 73 years and now for the next seven, so the first 8 years of Israel's existence is going to be a man. Maybe in 2028, they'll finally elect a woman to the job. But every president has played the role allowed to him by the prime minister. Now, some presidents, Shimon Peres, for example, in the early years of his presidency, was given a lot of space to carry out various diplomatic missions on behalf of Israel. Netanyahu himself sent him a few times. Towards the end, Netanyahu started reining him in. And it's the same with all the relationships between prime ministers and presidents. They were allowed to do some things, but at the end of the day, they could only work with the government that they'd been given and with Israeli society as they found it. And I think that when I wrote earlier this week that Rivlin was the best president that Israel could have expected in this period, Rivlin was the president of the last 7 years of the Netanyahu era. And Netanyahu has always been a he's no longer the prime minister, but always as prime minister had very much of a presidential tendency. Mm. He didn't even think there should be a president. There was even once or twice attempts by him to change the law, but that didn't go very far. He said he didn't regard someone else as being the head of state, so certainly not on important diplomatic meetings, certainly not in any major public event. I mean, you take, for example, the COVID vaccination just 6 months ago. Mm. You would have expected, also, the president is older than Netanyahu. He's if I'm not mistaken, 9 years older than Netanyahu. Since the first people to be vaccinated were the elderly, you would have thought the right thing to do would have been allowed Rivlin to take the first jab. But obviously, Netanyahu rushed to be the first Israeli to be jabbed, and Rivlin, his time came a few days later. And there are so many other examples that you could bring. And it's obviously not just the fact that Netanyahu didn't see much of a role for any president. Netanyahu has seen Rivlin for the last decade at least as much too independent. Rivlin is an old school Likudnik. Mm. He and Netanyahu actually go back to childhood because they're both, their mothers were from Petah Tikva, which was then not the bustling city of today, but a rather much smaller agricultural community. Both Mrs. Rivlin and Mrs. Netanyahu had come from families who were from the from the earliest pioneers in Petah Tikva, and the families would still meet there over the summer. Rivlin claims to have seen Netanyahu take his first steps, baby Bibi's first steps. And over the years, when they both became Likud activists, there were the relationship between them wasn't a bad one, and Netanyahu backed Rivlin being Knesset speaker until a point where he felt that Rivlin, as Speaker of the Knesset, was much too independent and was prioritizing parliamentary procedure and decorum above Netanyahu's own political interests, and therefore, after in 2013, Netanyahu endorsed Yuli Edelstein as the new leader of the Knesset instead of Rivlin, and that was, you know, that was really probably where their relationship reached rock bottom, because Rivlin expected to continue as Speaker. It was clear they didn't trust each other. Netanyahu, in 2014, when Rivlin ran for the second time as for the presidency, did everything he could to find someone else, including calling up Elie Wiesel in New York. Elie Wiesel was dying of cancer at the time. And Netanyahu said, "I want you to be the president of Israel." He said, "But I'm not even in Israel." He says, "It's okay, we'll sort out."
The Albert Einstein principle.
Well, it's true. Ben-Gurion tried to do the same thing with Einstein after Weizmann died in 1952. But that wasn't to screw someone else over. It was because he wanted, in the same way that Weizmann had been a world-renowned scientist, you know, he wanted to improve on that and take the most famous Jewish scientist. Einstein preferred to remain in Princeton, obviously. But Wiesel was like flabbergasted. Well, you've got people who can be present. And he brushed Netanyahu off. Netanyahu's last attempt was to totally cancel the office, failed at that. And this was one of the rare successful rebellions against Netanyahu within Likud, with a number of Likud ministers and backbenchers getting together to endorse Rivlin and ensure his election. But this was very much against Netanyahu's wishes. And he's treated Rivlin like that ever since. He's treated him as a nuisance.
Mm. You wrote that Rivlin was quintessential old-school Likudnik. Do you think he voted Likud in the last election?
I don't think I would it be right to speculate?
Yeah, I think so.
Look, we know that he's very close to Gideon Saar, the head of New Hope, the party of Likudniks who hate Bibi so much they can't be Likudniks anymore. Mm. Rivlin is very much of that mind and of that type of what is now an ex-Likudnik. So yeah, I wouldn't have been at all surprised if he'd voted for New Hope.
So, Yossi Werther, Haaretz's senior political analyst, wrote that Rivlin tried to unite the people of Israel, but ended up upsetting many. Who did he upset and how? I mean, we know that he angered Bibi, for example, and we've mentioned this already, by asserting that he'd witnessed a continued effort to weaken the gatekeepers of Israeli democracy.
Well, he angered Netanyahu just by being elected to the job. I mean, Rivlin is a staunch right winger. Let's not say, let's not beat around the bush. He is an old school Herut Jabotinskian ideologue. But that type of Jabotinsky, what they call hadar, decorum, dignity, national pride, but not in a not in a populist way, but in a, what you said at the beginning, with some pomp and grandeur as well. That's the old school Likudnik. That's, you know, Rivlin is that kind of Likudnik, and that also means that you conduct yourself even with, especially with your political rivals and opponents, in a much more respectful way. And there should be a discourse, and you shouldn't see your political rival as an enemy or someone who's against the state. And the whole Netanyahu way of doing politics, of tainting the left as being traitors, and as using Arab Israelis as for the dog whistles to appeal to the racism of his base, this is totally alien to the way that Rivlin believed that Likud should be doing politics. And he was basically became the president of the parts of Israel, Israeli society, Israeli politics, who were not part of Netanyahu's coalition. So despite it being a Likud government, he became the president of everyone who's not in the Likud government, everyone who doesn't feel part of that coalition of resentment and xenophobia. And, you know, he made a point of reaching out to these, to different parts. He was the first Israeli president to go to Kfar Qasim to commemorate the massacre there in 1956.
Yeah.
Before him, the most presidents before Rivlin were to the left of him. None of them went. So he made a point. He, the Likudnik, the Beitari, he went to the Kfar Qasim memorial. And you know, that was the way he conducted himself throughout. When Jewish settlers burnt down a house in Duma, killing three family members, including a baby, he said probably what was the most controversial statement of his presidency, that members of my people have chosen the path of terror. Mm.
And he received death threats for that.
The right wing hasn't forgiven him, and they won't forgive him for saying that. But it's not just that. It's by daring to say to Israelis there are a different way of conducting politics, a different way of conducting public debate. And in the time of Netanyahu, you know, that is what Israel could hope to get from a president who would try and reverse the tide of divisiveness, try and unite people. But it doesn't work with everyone. You know, there's a reason people voted for Netanyahu and for his allies, because anger and fear and nationalism and xenophobia work, as we've seen not just in Israel.
Mm. Many are saying that his four tribes speech was the defining moment of Rivlin's presidency. Would you agree with that?
Not necessarily, because the four tribes speech was a part of a wider project that he called Israeli Hope, and that was supposed to actually do various social projects and so on. And that that probably didn't really kick off. It didn't get backing from government agencies. Rivlin, unlike Shimon Peres, wasn't a great fundraiser himself. So his intention was actually to make a whole a whole series of projects and things happening around the country. And what remained from that is the tribe speech. I don't think Rivlin told us anything we don't know by saying that they're tribes, but it certainly is one of the more memorable speeches. I don't think it's his legacy, because at the end of the day, those tribes are very much in existence still, very much apart. And Rivlin's aspiration in that speech to bring them closer together hasn't really been realized yet. Mm.
So, writing in Haaretz, Charles Bronfman and Jeffrey Solomon claimed that one of the most consequential decisions affecting the future of world Jewry is the June the 2nd Knesset election of Israel's 11th president. Is that true?
No.
Is it inconsequential for world Jewry? What is the relationship between the president of the state of Israel?
Those two gentlemen you mentioned as two mega machers and so on, they like meeting presidents. Now, there's this like idea that I have no idea where it came from, that the president of Israel is the president of the Jewish people. The president of the Jewish people is Joe Biden. There's no politician, no elected official in the world who's received more votes of Jews than the president of the United States, going back I don't know how long. Well, actually, Donald Trump didn't get that many, but certainly when there's a Democrat president in the White House, you know, that's the person who's received the most votes of Jews anywhere. So no, and Joe Biden is not a president of Jewish people either. There is the president of Israel. Israel is numerically perhaps half of the world Jewish population, I think a bit slightly less, but there'll be arguments with demographers. Yes, the president has a role to play, certainly in relationship with the diaspora, in the sense that there are many foreign relation issues that Israel has. One of them is with the diaspora. The prime minister and the foreign minister usually are focused on other issues, less on the Jews. So the president is, you know, he's got more time to host Jewish groups and so on. But as a
figurehead?
Look, you know, both of us have lived in Jewish communities abroad. I don't remember ever having any notion, you know, certainly as a kid living in Britain, who the president of Israel was. I knew as a kid who the prime minister of Israel was, because I remember the Camp David being signed. I remember Menachem Begin signed. I remember reading about that in the, you know, also watching on the telly. Did you know as a kid in the UK who the president of Israel was?
His name was often inserted into the prayer for the welfare of the prime minister and president of the state of Israel.
And you listen closely to that.
Well, it may have seeped in.
But the thing is that for grandees like Bronfman and the other chap you mentioned, yes, they, for them, the president of Israel is somebody. But for most diaspora Jews, they don't even know who the president of Israel is. And it's not a consequential figure for them, and there's no reason he should be.
Mm. All right, Anshul, let's move on to Isaac Herzog. the first thing to point out is that he's continuing a tradition that would be more honoured in the breaching than in the observance, in my opinion. Israeli politicians and presidents having infantile nicknames. We've just had Ruby Rivlin, and now we're getting Bougie Herzog. What is it with these nicknames? Bibi, Bougie, Baiga, Ruby, Moody, Cheech, Gandhi. We even had a pretty racist Chinee at one stage. Anyway, let's move swiftly on from that. Herzog was elected.
Less said the better.
Yeah. Indeed. Anshush. Herzog was elected by the biggest majority of Knesset members in Israel's history. 87 MKs voted for him, while his rival Miriam Peretz got just 27 votes. Do you think that Herzog would have been elected president if the Israeli people had had a vote?
Probably not. Miriam Peretz is a figure who Israelis certainly feel warmer about. Perhaps not for the best reasons, the fact that two of her sons died in action both were in Golani, and one was killed in Gaza and one was killed in Lebanon. For that sad reason, Israelis certainly feel a lot warmer towards her. Bougie is a politician that Israelis like. They don't dislike him, but it's not that kind of same feeling of warmth. And certainly if they were going head to head in a national election, she would probably win. Who knows, campaigns work differently. But the thing about Herzog, which is really fascinating, that he was leader of Labour who lost against Netanyahu in 2015. And Netanyahu was at a low point then. Herzog ran a good race, got 24 seats to Likud's 30. Perhaps he could have won. He could certainly have won if he had been more ruthless in pushing aside smaller rivals like Yair Lapid, Yesh Atid, and so on. So Herzog, as a politician who runs in a national race, didn't do that well. But Herzog, as you mentioned, won more votes than any other president in the small, what we call in Britain a selectorate. Mm-hmm. It's like it's not the electorate, it's 120 Knesset members. But this is the second time that Herzog's broken a record in being elected to a senior position. His last job, he's been for 3 years now the chairman of the Jewish Agency. He was elected chairman of the Jewish Agency by the board of the Jewish Agency, which is also a pretty small selectorate. He's the only person to be elected chairman of the Jewish Agency despite the wishes of Israel's prime minister. Usually the board of governors, usually every single time until Bougie Herzog became the chairman of the Jewish Agency, the board of governors would have some kind of like discreet conversations with the prime minister, and then they would end up appointing the candidate endorsed by the prime minister. So Herzog has succeeded twice in breaking a record within a selectorate, whereas he's much less successful in a wider national election, which kind of shows you the kind of man he is. He's very, very good at pumping the flesh, at like going from MK to MK, from board member to board member. Herzog has spoken not just to the 120 MKs who were in the last election. He spoke to about 180 MKs because he's been doing this for 3 years, and we've had a lot of Knesset elections and a lot of change. Now, Herzog, 3 years ago when he became the chairman of the Jewish Agency, I asked him, is this your preparation for a presidential run? And he wouldn't answer. Everybody knew that was what he was doing. He'd already assembled 3 years ago a team for this. And every single Knesset member, and everybody who knows a Knesset member, has an influence a Knesset member, Herzog had been talking to them, including, and this is to his shame, with the Kahanist Itamar Ben-Gvir. And we should remember that after the 1984 election, as part of the traditional party consultation, he refused to receive at the president's residence Mayor Kahana. That was a very powerful statement that he would not accept this racist politician. Bougie did pursue Itamar Ben-Gvir and other neo-Kahanists in his looking for their endorsement. By the way, they voted for Miriam Peretz.
So it wasn't quite as successful as his other campaigning. Would it be fair to say that it was his destiny to be president? I mean, he's the closest thing that you get to aristocracy in Israel. He's even going to be sworn in on the same Bible that his father used when he was sworn in 1983.
Yeah, well, it's destiny in the sense that that nepotism is destiny. I mean, he's got the experience. He knows how to handle himself in diplomatic and political situations. He's a very competent president, but. Mm. There is a slight unpleasant feeling of nepotism.
I mean,
this is not. Yeah, there's no royal family, thank God, here. And, I mean, I think we're both staunch Republicans, I hope, in the English sense. I know I am. And the idea that the son of a president... It's not like Israel's been around 500 years and we've had 100 presidents. It's just the 11th president. The fact that two of the presidents are called Weizmann and two of them are called Herzog... It's... You know, I personally don't like it.
Right, I mean...
It's nothing personal against Bougie. I think it's in bad taste for the son of a president to be a president as well.
As the Haaretz editorial said, his aristocratic background leaves a bad taste in the mouth. But nonetheless, he was the better of the two candidates, according to Haaretz.
And I didn't even read the editorial. Strangely enough, I agree.
As it happens, Herzog got an almost unprecedented double endorsement on the pages of Haaretz, and Yossi Werther wrote that he's the right person in the right place at the right time.
Like I say, he's very competent. He certainly, his CV is a good one for this job,
and his family tree
that as well.
So, if Rivlin was the moderate face of the Likud, is it fair to say that Herzog is the Labour equivalent? He was never on the leftist fringes of that party, right?
Well, he was certainly a very centrist politician. He would never. Certainly not in recent years, have called himself left. He's very much of that part of Labour which tried to drag Labour into the as far into the centre ground as possible, which is also the reason why he couldn't save Labour, because the centre ground had already been occupied by Yair Lapid, and Herzog, for various reasons, didn't take the fight to Lapid.
How will he work with the Bennett-Lapid government?
I think they'll work very well together, isn't it? Herzog understands the office. He knows exactly the limitations. He knows what he can do, what he can't do. And because, you know, Lapid and Bennett are also not looking for any for any unnecessary political fights, you know, they'll try and deploy him where it's useful for them. I think they'll work together. I think I'll be surprised. I mean, Herzog is now beginning a 7-year term. I don't know how long the Lapid government will last. And if it does last, then Lapid will replace Bennett in a couple of years. But I'll be surprised if either Bennett or Lapid pick any fights with Herzog. This is a government which has so much trouble, so much issues anyway, that they're going to try and not pick too much fights that they shouldn't be having. That said, there always is some kind of inbuilt tension between the president and the prime minister. That you can't always you can't always predict where that will be, but I don't see this being one of the more difficult relationships.
So on the personal level, is he as vanilla as he seems? I mean, his Wikipedia page doesn't even have a controversies section, and there was the semi-controversy where he sparred with comedian Seth Rogen a couple of years ago.
Well, I think if you go further back, you'll find a number of investigative reports, mainly by our Gidi Weitz, with some less vanilla dealings that Herzog had back in his days as a Labour politician. You know, and famously, he kept the right of silence 20 years ago in the NGO's investigation over the funding of Ehud Barak's 1999 campaign, of which Herzog was a senior official in that campaign. So, you know, Herzog is not, he's behind that mild-mannered Clark Kent kind of exterior, there is a very sharp and sometimes scheming political mind. Look, this is a man who grew up from childhood, both in national politics and and also slightly in religious politics. You know, his grandfather was a chief rabbi, so Herzog is not someone to trifle with. He understands the fine arts or the dark arts of political skullduggery, even if he doesn't look like a practitioner of them, he is.
One storm that may be accompanying Herzog into the president's residence is the appointment of a new spokesman, Noor Yichia. What's that all about?
Well, most Israelis have never heard of Noor Yichia. He's a person only known to political correspondents, because he was one of Netanyahu's spokespeople, less obtrusive than some of the others who have actually had more of a public stand. He's very much a man in the background. And Herzog has now appointed him as his new spokesperson, angering that section which of the center left, we should put best called the Balfour protest section, who, like, anything which reminds you of Netanyahu must be exorcised from public life. I mean, there is I can see merits in both arguments. Those who are saying, well, he's just a professional, he was just doing his job, and those who are saying, well, he actually did say some very he did push some very toxic messages on behalf of Netanyahu. But I'm less worried about Nahuich. He is a professional. I think he did cross the line in some of the things he did for Netanyahu, but at the end of the day, we were just following orders clause to fall back upon. But the real question is what Herzog is going to do if and when Netanyahu approaches him for a pardon.
Yeah.
And there are, he wouldn't be drawn about that in any of the interviews he gave during his campaign for the presidency. His father, I'm sorry, we're always going back to his father, but Chaim Herzog famously gave the bus 300 pardons to the senior Shin Bet officials who were involved in murdering two captured terrorists, mm-hmm. who had been among the hijackers of bus 300. And not only did they get a pardon, they got a pardon even before their convictions. So basically, they got a preliminary pardon, which saved them from having to go through the whole court procedures and tell all these dark stories about what was happening in the dungeons and the Shin Bet. Now, Netanyahu is already on trial, but that trial could carry on for years. Will probably carry on for years.
Perhaps even beyond Herzog's 7-year tenure.
Well, that's taking things a bit far, but it'll probably go deep into Herzog's tenure. But it's a nuisance for Netanyahu. It's costing him a shit ton of money in legal fees. It'd probably be at least in shekels, at least an 8-figure fee. And there are reports that Herzog has been given some kind of legal opinion on the possibilities of giving Netanyahu such a pardon. Now, will he do it? Does he want to brave the public outcry? Will there be a public outcry? Maybe a lot of Israelis, and I wouldn't be surprised, beyond that very noisy Balfour protest faction, I think a lot of Israelis would be relieved for Netanyahu to be pardoned, for all this to go away, if there's as a condition Netanyahu also does not seek public office again. So the question, if the quid pro quo is that he won't remain a Knesset member, he won't ever run for the prime minister's job again, then I think a lot of people will say, let's not go through the next few years of this trial, and then who knows, another prime minister in prison. It's not the way to go about it, certainly, to give him a pardon before conviction. But even a lot of Israelis who did not vote and who are not supporters of Netanyahu would be relieved.
Well, we shall see. Anshul, it is time for us to vacate the studio. Thank you for your time and your insights, as always.
Yechim Medinat Yisrael, and it's coming home.
Thank you, too, to our producer, Aaron Ehrlich, and to you, listener, for tuning in. We'll be back on Monday with another episode of Haaretz Weekly. Until then, Shabbat Shalom from Tel Aviv, and long live the President.